Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Well, hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, I have no comments today, and again, I think that's a good thing. Over the last several programs, we have been working through Chapter 7 of Michael Korda's book, Hero. That chapter is titled 1917, The Uncrowned King of Arabia. And one thing I need to mention at this point, I think, in our discussion is that we're not going to be discussing all of this chapter. And, for example, I don't believe it's necessary for us to be talking about Lawrence's torture at Daraha. And I don't think that should be open to the public discussion. It was an incident he never completely recovered from. He was deeply scarred by it for the rest of his short life. There's been a lot of people analyze and psychoanalyze the man. We're not going to do that on the radio. We do have a lot of respect for him and certainly for his courage and his desire to be a hero. We need heroes today, more like him than we have. But I do feel it's very important that we talk about the Balfour Declaration. Now, Korda doesn't give us a lot on that in the book. He does talk about it somewhat. And since we're discussing the events in 1917, I thought this would be a great time to do it. Now, the Balfour Declaration itself is very short, but the document has a history of conflict. And I just want to read it to you, just to show you how short it is, and then we'll begin to open up our discussion on it. This is from the Foreign Office, November 2nd, 1917, and it begins, "Dear Lord Rothschild, I have much pleasure in conveying to you, on behalf of His Majesty's government, the following declaration of sympathy with Jewish Zionist aspirations, which has been submitted to and approved by the Cabinet. His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. I should be grateful if you would bring this declaration to the knowledge of the Zionist Federation. Yours, Arthur James Balfour." And of course, he was the British Foreign Secretary at the time. Now, to help me discuss this important document, I do have with me in the studio today Mr. Brent Nottigall, who is host of KPCG's Watch Jerusalem radio program. So Brent is here in the States with his wife and children. They're visiting our headquarters campus here in Edmond. And so he's coming to us from his residence in Jerusalem. So welcome, Brent.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on your show.
Oh, well, this is awesome. We need this cross-fertilization. So, thanks for taking the time to help me discuss this important document. Now, I have been reading a book on the subject outside of Korda's book. And that book is titled The Balfour Declaration, The Origins of the Arab-Israeli Conflict. And it's by Jonathan Schneer. Now, I think it's a fascinating book. I do highly recommend it to all of you JBL listeners out there. It gives you much more detail than Korda's book does on the same subjects. But I'm not so sure I like the title. And I know that, that Brent has written articles on the Balfour Declaration. Being involved in Jerusalem the way he is, he's helped us on our archaeological projects. He is our man on the street in Jerusalem for the Trumpet and the Trumpet.com, and so he's deeply involved in all the events there. So I would just like to read to you that even another quote from this book. I know on a previous program, one of our panel members said that the Balfour Declaration was not a good document or wasn't a, and after reading this book, I don't necessarily agree with that. And also my discussions with Brent, I don't agree with that. So we want to make sure we clear some of that up today. But here's what actually Schneer does say in his opening to the book, and I think it's a good quote, and we're going to get Brent to weigh in on this quote as well. But here's what he says. This is page 14 of the new book I'm reading. It's called The Balfour Declaration. It says, "The Balfour Declaration was not, in and of itself, the source of trouble in a land that previously had been more or less at peace. But nor was it a mere signpost on a road heading inadvertently toward a cliff. No one can say what the course of events in Palestine might have been without it. What did come about was the product of forces and factors entirely unforeseen." So I think that paragraph does pretty much sum up what we are dealing with when we talk about the Balfour Declaration. But I'd just like to know what you think, Brent. How do you weigh in on that quote?
I think it's pretty good in that it shows that the original intent of the Balfour Declaration wasn't to impact the Arabs at all. They would have been respected in many ways. And even as we would probably get to, the chief architects of the Balfour Declaration, the Jewish ones, and in accordance with some of the Arab leaders at the time, right when it was signed and shortly thereafter in the First World War, were grateful for each other's presence in the land, and there was not Arab rejectionism of the Balfour Declaration itself. Now, it has been painted, let's say, ever since probably like 1922, like shortly thereafter, from that point forward, going through even when Israel became a state and the different wars, and even the Mahmoud Abbas, the president of the Palestinian Authority, he labels Balfour as the original sin that brought the Jews to Israel, to this land of Palestine that used to be theirs. And I think we have had this great historical revisionism on Balfour, especially over the past 50 years, and especially in maybe the past 3 years, 2 years, as we came to the centenary 2 years ago. It was talked about all the time. And all the Arab leaders were discussing with Britain, please renounce Balfour, renounce it. You know, how can you even accept that your government did such a thing? And yet the British government did come on strong and say they were proud of it still. But you really have to go back to 1916, 17, and see how, as he even brings out in that quote, that this was the product of forces and factors entirely unforeseen, this agreement. There was, I believe, God's hand behind this agreement. And the other factors that led to its being. We see a brief moment of time when such a declaration could be given by the power of the land, being the British Empire, power of the world at the time, bestowing upon the Jews a homeland that they hadn't, or a potential homeland upon them that they hadn't received for 2,000 years. And so it's a pretty majestic moment.
Yeah, I think one of the things that you brought out just here in the last few minutes is the revisionist history. And I know that I've thought a lot about this. Of course, I was raised Roman Catholic. I always call it Roman Irish Catholic. And there is a good measure of anti-Semitism, you know, in the Catholic Church. We just have to be honest about that. And I know when you ever heard the word Zionism, it could like bring up the hackles on the back of your neck, you know, like, wow, this is really bad stuff. But since I've kind of been awakened to real history, there's a lot of history behind this that has just been completely forgotten. And certainly, I think I can also honestly say that the Catholics have everyone is sincere in their beliefs. I don't want to criticize anybody for their beliefs, but they're not Bible readers. And Bible history says this is the Jewish homeland. I mean, where Jerusalem is, and of course, it was called Judea at one time, not just Palestine. I mean, those are kind of modern interventions by the pro-Arab League or by the pro-Arabic intellectuals that are out there. And so I think it's good that you bring out some of this pro-Zionist history. You know, how it all got started. And I think maybe I can, because of Korda's book, and of course I've had the chance to read this Balfour Declaration, is that I know from reading both, in the very beginning, the Arab the Arabic peoples were in favor of the Jews, you know, having a homeland and being in that area. In fact, there were Jews already living in the area before World War I.
Right. I mean, you had the big Jewish migrations to this land in the early 19th century before World War I, in response to a lot of what was happening in Russia. If Jews could get out of what was happening in East or Western Russia, basically, if people remember Fiddler on the Roof.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, that time period is right when this seed of Zionism was born. And this was an idea that the Jews have always lived in this area, even after the Romans expelled them in 70 AD.
Right.
There were plenty of Jews that lived in history through the Byzantine Empire and the Crusaders there, and even through the Ottoman period. There were always Jews in Jerusalem.
Right.
And so their historic attachment to the land is not just found in the Bible, but it's found in the history of the last 2,000 years. And really, there was a problem before World War II relating to Jewish assimilation inside Europe. And there were people that thought that it couldn't be done and that they needed to go somewhere else and have their own state. There were Jews that said that we're just been making headway in the early 1900s in France and Britain, and we are assimilating, and we've got high positions and high office, and there's Jews in the parliaments, and so it's great. So let's not distract everybody with this idea that we need our own homeland. And so you did have varying degrees of support amongst the Jewish community for this originally. But we tend to think of the birth of Israel as being purely the result of the Holocaust. And the Nazis were bad to the Jews, and they killed 6 million of them. And so finally, let's just give them a place of their own so that they can escape that and have somewhere to go. And so many of the Arab leaders today, I'm not saying it was that way, it definitely wasn't, want to portray the Jewish statehood as being the let's say Western guilt or trying to rectify Nazi guilt, let's put it that way, for what they did to the Jews. So let's give them a land. And they're like, well, what are they doing coming to our spot? This is our patch of the earth. Why not send them elsewhere? And they forget that 40 years previous to that, you already had mass Jewish migration to this area.
Right.
And you had it being supported by the main power of the land, of the earth, the British Empire.
Yeah, what few people realize is that it was the Tsar in Russia that said, you know, we're going to make a third of the Jews living in Russia, they're going to have to become, you know, Russian Orthodox. You know, a third of them, we're going to get rid of them. We're going to put them out of the country. And the other third are going to starve to death. I mean, that was the decision that was made before World War II.
Right, right. And so really, this is a declaration that really does honor the Jews with what many would see as their historical right to come back to a land that at the time the British were winning, as we'll get to, or are going to overcome and eventually have control over this territory to dictate, rightly or wrongly, they had the power to do so as being victorious and ousting the Ottomans that didn't have a right necessarily to this land either.
Right.
And so you really have to say, if we're going to talk about, you know, whether it's going to be the Arabs or the Jews. And that's why I don't really like the subtitle for that book, Origins of the Arab-Israeli Conflict, because it really did take place after Balfour. People were on board with Balfour. I would say that it was very rare that you had all these aligning factors that led to the Balfour Declaration, which the Jews were looking for basically a foreign power to give a statement like this, that they favored a Jewish homeland in the area of Palestine for the Jews. They were looking for somebody to do it, and eventually they settled on the British Empire as being the greatest. They put all their eggs in that basket. This was even prior to World War I and the fact that the Brits were starting to take this territory. Before they even knew that, they recognized that it was going to be Britain that would be in the position to say that this is a good idea.
And at that time, Britain was one of the most powerful nations on the earth.
And, for sure.
And the thing is, we also know that there's another connection. You know, there's actually a brotherhood there that we can talk about as we go through the program. But with the United States and Britain in prophecy, Mr. Armstrong shows that the Jews and the British, the Americans, you know, we're all brothers. We're the lost tribes of Israel. But Judah is the only one that's not lost.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we all know who the Jews are. But very few people know that the Americans are Manasseh and the British are Ephraimites. And those are astounding things. And it's, to me, it's really exciting that here, you know, a brother would help a brother and get them established again.
Yeah, it is really interesting because, as you say, they are brothers, and there is a counter to that in a way, because we know that Ephraim anciently and Judah, who are the Jewish nation today, they sometimes didn't get along.
No,
it's actually an enmity that God says he's going to have to heal, because these brothers, you know, one forms has the head or the Davidic line comes through one tribe, and Ephraim's the birthright, one of the birthright nations. So there was always this little bit of sibling rivalry between the two. And yet, for this moment in history, I'd say a five-year period, around the starting of World War, and let's say middle of World War One to like 1920, you had pro-Jewish leaders, be it the Prime Minister, be it Balfour himself, the Foreign Secretary, that really did favor a Jewish homeland, that had not anti-Semitic views. A lot of the Brits before and after did hold some anti-Semitic views.
Right.
But these two men specifically had a number of chance meetings with the Jewish movement before World War One, and so it was on their mind. And Lloyd George, who was the Prime Minister at the time, he actually said that he knew the kings of Israel more than he knew the Prime Ministers of Britain, or the kings of Britain. He recollected this history and had a romance attached to that history and a romantic notion, and believed that the Jews did deserve that homeland back. And back is the right word.
Right.
Because if you look at, you read through the official version of the Balfour Declaration, but there were many revisions that went through that to get to that point. And each time it was revised, it became a little bit more watered down. If you read the very first version, it talked about the Jews going back or reconstituting the place where they used to inhabit. Like, this is a going back. This isn't a going to a place. This is returning to where
returning
you
home.
Lived,
right.
Returning home.
Yeah.
And the British government, at least in that first one, it looked like they were going to secure the establishment of a Jewish people, not just favor or facilitate. And it didn't have any mention of even looking after the Arab population. So I believe the final version is a good one, because it does include some elements that the first didn't. But it does indicate that there was this pro-Israeli, if we can call it that, Jewish, I guess Israeli didn't exist at the time, sentiment there for a few years that existed in Jewish leadership, in
right.
the British leadership.
Yeah, I think it'd be good if you could maybe talk a little bit about the background of that, because I know when we talked this morning to get ready for the programs, that was really fascinating to me that there was more than one version.
Yeah.
Because all you can get on the internet is this short little statement. But the fact that, they were leading there were Jewish members of parliament that probably had comments in it.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
We can talk more about the Arabic side as we go through this. But when we talk about, you know, the Jews and the English being brothers, well, the Jews and the Arabs are cousins.
Right. That's all family.
It's all family.
If you study biblical history as well, they're all family going back. And
if you go biblically, some of the Arabic are Ishmaelites.
Right.
They were the son of Abraham, just
right.
like Jacob was the son of Abraham. And then, of course, you have Esau, who was the brother of Jacob. Some of the Arabic peoples are from, you know, especially the Turks are from Esau.
Right.
And so they're all cousins. Unfortunately, it does show that Abraham and Sarah made a big mistake in getting Hagar involved, because they couldn't be patient enough to wait for God to give him Isaac. And so, you know, this whole conflict goes back years, mm-hmm. not to a Balfour Declaration.
Right.
You know, it goes back in history thousands of years.
And it is, this is kind of off topic, so I don't know if I should comment on it, but you do have these moments in Jewish Arab history where you have leaders that recognize that fact. And I think Balfour, or 1917, leaders did. And then if you go to Menachem Begin and Anwar Sadat, when Sadat came in the 70s and spoke at the Knesset, what does
right.
he go with? We're brothers. It's like they
That's
recognize
right.
that we are family, that in some ways when we recognize that we're family, we can get along. But when we forget those familial ties, we can be at each other's throats. And so there are these moments in history where they can come together and recognize that fact. But going back to your original just question about these different drafts, the Balfour Declaration itself was something that Balfour asked of Lord Rothschild. Lord Rothschild, basically the Rothschilds are one of the biggest Jewish families in Britain and really eventually the rest of the world. And he did.
And very wealthy.
And yeah. he was not originally a Zionist himself. He was really late to the Zionism trend, probably back in 1916 is when he came along. And he was a member of the Commons, so he was part of the Jewish British Parliament system. And you had Balfour, who was the Foreign Secretary, that asked him and Chaim Weizmann. Chaim Weizmann was one of the Jewish leaders for Zionism that came out of the Pale of Settlement in Ukraine in the turn of the 20th century. And so he was charged, Rothschild was, and Weizmann, by the Foreign Secretary of producing a document that says basically that us, the British Empire, and the Queen and everybody favor the Jewish homeland, that people can go back and live there. This was going to accomplish a number of things. It was going to finally give the Jews somewhere to go after facing anti-Semitism for 2,000 years or even before that, really. We tend to think again of the Nazis, but you've got the Russian pogroms, you've got what happened in Spain, you've got what happened in Italy. It just happens time and time again. And so this was a solution to that. At least the Jews would have somewhere to retreat to. And it would also solve the problem of assimilation, because there were plenty of Jews that did not want to assimilate into the culture in which they were living in Western Europe and elsewhere. And so it would help with that. And so Rothschild and Weizmann, who was very much a supporter of going back to specifically Palestine, he was given the charge of coming up with the original draft. And so those two did. They had the other help of some other Jewish academics. They came out with the first draft. I'll read the first draft for you. This was July 18, 1917. So this is a full like 5 months before the original the final draft was settled on. It says this: His Majesty's, so not the Queen, the King, sorry, His Majesty's government accepts the principle that Palestine should be reconstituted as the national home of the Jewish people. His Majesty's government will use its best endeavors to secure the achievement of this object and will discuss the necessary methods and means with the Zionist organization. And so this is very strong. It's the Brits that recognize that this is a going back, a reconstitution of this land, a national home of the Jewish people as it was their land before. And then it would be securing this, which means the might of the British Empire is going to accomplish this and ensure that it happens. Now, this would go through, it would originally be approved by the cabinet itself, that the idea that this is something that we're going to work towards. And then it would go through four revisions. And some of these revisions were done by anti-Zionist Jews that wanted to water down the language to the point that those Jews that didn't want to go to Palestine wouldn't be affected. And that's understandable as well. So if you go to the final reading of it, if I could borrow your piece of paper, just see a couple of things that would change as time went on throughout this six-month period. It says this: His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people. So notice that it is now in Palestine. It's not just Palestine. So this involves a smaller territory, or potentially a smaller territory, than the whole area of Palestine. And then it says this: we use its best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object. We're going to help, but we're not responsible to secure it in the end. And then it says at the end that it's being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of the existing non-Jewish communities, basically the Arabs. They're not going to be impacted negatively by it in Palestine, or the rights and political status of enjoyed by the Jews in other countries, meaning the establishment of this state doesn't mean all Jews have to leave everywhere else and go there. If Jews are happy to assimilate in the countries in which they are, they don't have to go. And so I don't think this is necessarily a worse document. I think it's including elements that should be there. But it was watered down over time, because most of the apprehension towards a Jewish homeland was from Jews themselves, worried that they were going to lose the gains that they had made in Western Europe as far as being a part of those societies. But nevertheless, these number of leaders did come together. Balfour, as the foreign secretary, who was a Bible reader, who actually he saw not just the fact that the Jews did belong in this land, but that it could actually help the British Empire as well to have an ally in that portion of the world. But then Lloyd George himself, the Prime Minister, he favored it immensely. But then by the time you get to 1922, I mean, the last very pro-Jewish leader is gone. Lloyd George is out. Shortly thereafter, Balfour is gone. And you see the desire of the British Empire to walk it back, what they'd already agreed to.
It's the liberals, the liberal politicians that were that started to walk it back. Well, I just hate to say this, but this always happens. We are out of time for today's program. So next time, what we'll do is we'll continue our discussion of the Balfour Declaration. And we are rapidly concluding our series of programs on T.E. Lawrence using Michael Korda's book, Hero, The Life and Legend of Lawrence of Arabia. In the first week of November, we will begin a new series titled A Tribute to Charles Krauthammer. We will be reading major parts of his book of essays titled Things That Matter. You can buy this book at Amazon.com. You can find a used copy of the book at abebooks.com. And, of course, you can also check your local library. So please write me any comments you may have to JBL at PCOG.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at JBLiterature1. I just wanted to say we're getting new quotes up there for you all the time. And there'll be more announcements up there. So I have the help to do that now. So please keep checking into JBLiterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.